Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There were three ravens sat on a tree. Down a down, hey, down a down. They were as black as they might be with a down. One of them said to his mate, "Where shall we our breakfast take? With a down, dairy, 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 down, down."
Hello and welcome to an all-new series of the Three Ravens podcast. I'm Martin.
And I'm Eleanor.
And in this episode, we're talking about Suffolk. I'm telling my take on a story with roots in the 14th century, the Rat Piper of Beccles. And along the way, we'll be addressing big questions, like who the heck was the Wizard of Ipswich? Where in Suffolk you should go if you'd like to summon the devil? And how should you rightly respond if a farmer gives you a Suffolk punch?
Yes, receiving a Suffolk punch isn't necessarily painful. But we'll reveal why in a little bit. Still, Series 4, Dearest Ravens, we're back for our second lap.
We sure are. And as always, Eleanor is entirely correct. After venturing around England's 39 historic counties across three series of folklore-themed fun and storytelling, we're beginning again. Only this time, we're switching roles.
As you'll know if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, Martin and I take turns to curate our episodes. So one week I take the lead and write the story that week. The next week he does. And so we've each written about and investigated and given a take on a tale based on a legend from half of England's counties.
Yeah.
So by switching roles, all the counties I covered before, Martin will cover, and all the counties he covered before, it's over to me.
Which is very exciting for us both. Last year, we mostly picked counties we knew better, such as this one, Suffolk. You were born there. I've only visited it with you. Whereas next week, you're going to be talking about Somerset, the county where I was born.
And a county I've only really ventured around with you.
Yeah.
So we're each going to be offering new perspectives, new thoughts and ideas, new folklore, and most excitingly, new stories.
We will indeed. But before we leap headlong into the episode, we should start off in the customary way by thanking our new supporters on Patreon. And because we've been away for over a month in the gap between series 3 and 4, we have quite a few to thank. So, welcome to the Conspiracy of Ravens. TJ, Angela, Harris, Mary, Angie, Dominic, J-Cat, Barbara, Mark, Kevin, Robert, Liam, and Jimmy.
All hail TJ, King of Patreon.
All hail Angela, King of Patreon.
All hail Harris, King of Patreon.
All hail Mary, King of Patreon.
All hail Angie, King of Patreon.
All hail Dominic, King of Patreon.
All hail J-Cat, King of Patreon.
All hail Barbara, King of Patreon.
All hail Mark, King of Patreon.
All hail Kevin, King of Patreon.
All hail Robert, King of Patreon.
All hail Liam, King of Patreon.
All hail Jimmy, King of Patreon.
What a stonkingly long list.
Gronkingly long list, more like it. Yes. I love how you did a different voice for everyone, but I looked at the length of the list and was just, you know.
I don't have that range. Anyway,
well,
yes.
I do, but it'll get weird.
A gronkingly long list. And just as a reminder to everyone, I kind of now run the Three Ravens as my job, and we buy books, go on research trips, all sorts of stuff, meaning every bit of support we receive on Patreon really does make a huge difference to Eleanor and I. Every person you convince to join the Three Ravens community in general really helps. The advertising revenue from every listen helps. But those people who support us on Patreon, you are the bedrock of Three Ravens. Thank you so much for all you do.
And to support us on Patreon, please sign up at patreon.com/Three Ravens Podcast. Membership is $3 a month or $6 a month. So that's £2.50 a month or £5 a month in sterling. Mm. The equivalent of buying one or both of us a coffee once a month.
Yeah.
And you can cancel at any time. But what joining the Patreon unlocks? Well, it's a treasure trove.
It is indeed. Because in addition to ad-free listening and our stories as text versions and our Monday episodes early, joining the Patreon unlocks our monthly newsletter full of folk customs for each month and all sorts of other goodies, from Celtic tree and zodiac information to seasonal tarot spreads, magic spells to try, cultural recommendations, and more. Plus, every month we release a beefy Patreon exclusive episode where we do something a little bit special.
For this month, the episode is called Three Lost Villages, and it sees Martin and I going on an audio tour of three once glorious places in Sussex,
yep,
now either mere shadows of themselves or fallen into total ruin. But from previous months, we have audio ghost tours of spooky places, specials to match the sabbats of the pagan wheel of the year, deep dives into particular topics and themes, and loads of additional stories. There's over a year of them to listen to, and they're pretty darn cool, even if we say so ourselves.
Plus, exclusive to Patreon, we also release episodes of the Three Ravens Film Club each month, a series where we review and chat about cult movies with a folkloric twist. Last month, it was The Devil Rides Out from 1968, starring Christopher Lee.
It's the Goat of Mendes, the devil himself.
And this month, we're watching Men, the 2022 folk horror film written and directed by Alex Garland, him what wrote The Beach and 28 Days Later, and who also directed Ex Machina, and whose new film, Civil War, is out in cinemas right now.
And whether or not you support us on Patreon, you're very much invited to take part in the Three Ravens Film Club.
Oh, yeah.
We encourage everyone in the Three Ravens community to watch the film we've picked for the month and either post their thoughts about the movies on our social media channels or email us thoughts about the film to threeravenspodcast@gmail.com.
Which is the same place to send us your local lore, folk tales, folk remedies, and general weird trivia for inclusion in our next listener episode.
As well as the place to send your entries to our brand new writing competition.
Oh, yes. And to be a bit more specific about that, off the back of our Folky Flash fiction competition, for which we had some absolutely wonderful entries, as heard on our recent Folky Flash fiction runners-up and winners episodes, we thought we'd try something similar, only with a new theme and a longer word count.
This time, we're inviting everyone in the Three Ravens community to write us an original ghost story.
Mm.
It can be based on personal experience or be completely made up, but we're looking for spooky tales that we'll read and judge, and then we'll perform the winning entries as part of this year's Three Ravens haunting season.
That's right. This October, just like last year, we'll be dedicating our episodes for the month to talking about otherworldly, spooky things and telling our own original ghost stories. But we want to also release your ghost stories alongside them, so bring them on!
Specifically, we're looking for tales of up to a maximum of 3,000 words. And we do count. You don't have to write something that long. We are very happy to receive shorter stories, but 3,000 words is the absolute upper limit.
Yep.
And you can send us your ghost stories as part of the competition right up until the end of Series 4, which will be in July.
Simple criteria. No more than 3,000 words. Include a ghost of some kind and make it spooky.
Please do. We want our gooses bumped and our spines tingled. Send those stories through to threeravenspodcast@gmail.com. We're very excited to be scared by you. And we're really looking forward to Haunting Season 2024. It's going to be one for the ages.
Also, if you like creepy fiction and a bit of horror and fantasy books filled with adventure and dark humour and grown-up stuff, please also consider listening to the other project that I've been working on.
Go, go, The Heartless Knaves.
Shall I play the trailer?
Yes, play the trailer.
The Heartless Knaves is a new dark fantasy audiobook podcast featuring clever heists, gory scraps, sad bits, saucy bits, murderous nuns, talking donkeys, and an 8-year-old boy king who won't take no for an answer. Set in a twisted version of the English Renaissance, the story hinges on the macabre adventures of assassins Silkin and Rooks, who may be dead, their hearts stolen by the church, their severed heads mounted on the royal battlements, but there's no rest for the wicked. Blending black humour and squishy violence with a whip-smart plot and a cast of lovable rogues, the first book, The Pale Princess, is a bit like a haunted roller coaster, fundamentally unsafe, shuddering in the wind, and threatening to come off the rails as it gathers pace. If you have ever been betrayed and wanted revenge, if you have ever had your heart cut out and wanted it back, if you have ever known something was sickeningly wrong and wanted to wreak havoc in reply, you are one of us. For we are the Heartless Knaves. Now, I'm not going to go on about the Heartless Knaves on the Three Ravens because they're very different projects, but if you're an adult, because it's not for kids, please do consider having a listen to The Heartless Knaves. It's available wherever you get your podcasts, and there are three chapters out already, with new ones coming out every Sunday.
I was the first person to read it. Martin kind of wrote it for me, yeah. And I absolutely love it. But I love a dark fantasy book.
You do. Anyway, so that's The Heartless Knaves. Thank you very much to the Three Ravens listeners who have been so kind about it already. But also, starting right now, we're introducing a whole book-related new thing to coincide with the start of series 4, namely the Three Ravens Book Club.
Yes, this was an idea we had a long time ago, but our Patreon supporter Paco gave us the nudge we needed to bring it to life. As such, we're very happy to announce that each month we're encouraging everyone in the Three Ravens community to read the same book. This month it's a new novel, Song of the Huntress by Lucy Holland, as voted for by our supporters on Patreon. So please read the book, and then we'll all chat about it on social media and meet together to talk about it on a YouTube live stream on Saturday, the 18th of May.
Yeah, it's a brand new book. Very pretty.
Yeah, great cover.
And to give everyone just a bit of the blurb, the book is set in Britain in 60 AD when, hoping to save her lover and her land from the Romans, Hurla makes a desperate pact with the Otherworld King. She becomes Lord of the Hunt, and for centuries she rides, reaping wanderers' souls, until one night she meets a woman on a bloody battlefield, a Saxon queen with ice blue eyes.
I'm so excited about this book. I'm going to crack it open as soon as we finish recording.
Details of the live stream will come out on our Facebook page via facebook.com/Three Ravens Podcast, as well as on Patreon, Instagram, and on our Twitter. But that's one of the big new things we're doing, but it's not the only thing.
No, it's not the only thing, because you, Martin, have been interviewing a whole bunch of genuine geniuses, artists, and experts for a new bonus series called Local Legends.
That's absolutely correct. Each and every Saturday, we'll be releasing a new fulsome interview with a genuine local legend from the county we've been talking about that week. We've got podcasters, we've got historians, we've got folklorists and authors and some pretty big cheeses, starting this Saturday with author of Suffolk Folktales and many other excellent books, Kirsty Hartsiotis.
We'll be playing a couple of short excerpts from the interview later in this episode when we're talking about Suffolk.
Yeah.
But to hear the whole thing in full, just keep an eye on the main Three Ravens podcast feed. That's where episodes of Local Legends will appear. And each conversation is going to offer a different perspective from a diverse range of voices about the counties we'll be covering this season.
Now, one last important notice before we crack on. The eagle-eyed among you may have seen that last year we launched Three Ravens with an episode about Sussex.
We did, our home county of Sussex.
This time around, however, we're going to be talking about Sussex in our Series 4 finale, because we'll be recording that episode in front of a live audience at Chichester Festival.
Our first Three Ravens live show. It's very exciting.
Tickets are on sale now, so if you'd like to come along and hear us record that episode live, telling stories and generally doing what we do every week, only with friends, plus our pal Ben Harbour will be there to play live underscoring for the story I'll be telling. and he'll also be playing the Three Ravens theme live with Eleanor singing.
And there'll be a Q&A as well. We are really looking forward to it.
We are. But please, if you live anywhere nearby, buy tickets for Three Ravens Live at Chichester Festival. If you do an online search for Three Ravens Live Chichester Festival, you will find it, and we'll hope to see you there.
And we will have more correspondence to talk about at the end, as well as some new reviews. Please, everyone, review Three Ravens wherever you listen.
Please.
But for now, that is more than enough business. Start of the season.
Yeah.
Always so much housekeeping.
Busy, busy.
Let's get on with the episode.
Okay, well, we're releasing this episode on Monday, the 22nd of April, which is a nothing day. No special festivals or obscure saints' days and so on. But tomorrow, Tuesday the 23rd, is St. George's Day.
And also, let's not forget, Shakespeare's birthday and death day. I mean, come on, Martin. St. George may be England's patron saint, but Shakespeare is on a whole other level.
I mean, you say that, but did Shakespeare slay any dragons?
Unclear. But also, not meaning to get too controversial too early, did St. George?
Ah, yes. Well, bit of a tricky one to answer, because St. George, who became patron saint of England in the 14th century, ousting our previous patron saint, Edward the Confessor.
Poor old Edward, elbowed aside by St. George. Rough stuff.
Yeah, now St. George is famous for a story in which he slayed a dragon, symbolic of the devil and evil and sin, unto which a princess had been sacrificed by a heathen Middle Eastern king. In the story, St. George is famously a Christian knight, and his story was especially popular with crusaders.
Yes, well, they're the ones who brought his legend back with them from the Crusades. And it's said that St. George even appeared in the skies above Antioch in 1098 to inspire the troops.
Yeah, which is pretty weird when you think about it. Huge saint leaning down from the clouds, offering the crusaders a huge thumbs up. Go for it, guys! You've got this!
I think we all need that.
Yeah, maybe. But even weirder when it comes to St. George, we have very little historical evidence to say that the person canonized as St. George ever existed, and he certainly never had anything to do with England.
There's a leading contender for who he was, isn't there?
Yeah.
A Roman general who's served with distinction, who was then beheaded for announcing his Christian faith under orders from Emperor Diocletian in 303 AD.
Indeed, and his popularity was inextricably linked with the mock chivalric institution established by Edward III, the Order of the Garter.
Well, St. George was made the patron of the Order of the Garter before he was made patron saint of England, wasn't he?
He was. And we've spoken about the Order of the Garter before, a very strange institution that continues today, headed up by King Prince Charles. And part of why St. George became so popular in England through into the Renaissance was mystery plays.
Yes, mystery plays. Those being seasonal pageants performed in town and village squares up and down the country, telling stories from the Bible, local legends, folk tales, and involving lots of bawdy songs and dressing up.
Yep, and what's not to like about a community amateur dramatics production where someone's uncle dresses up like a dragon and gets beaten up by someone else's uncle dressed as St. George?
There's actually one happening in Hayward's Heath
on
St. George's Day. Yes,
well,
I can confirm. I've seen the dragon.
Very cool.
As it was limbering up. But they don't happen a huge amount in England, that's for sure. It's just a coincidence that there is one up the road.
Well, the Reformation did away with most forms of mystery play. Various places have revived them over the years, particularly starting in the mid-19th century, and some counties have quite developed versions or fragmentary bits of mystery plays which endure. But one way in which St. George remains pretty famous these days is in the St. George's flag.
Yes, that's the English flag that's not the Union Jack, but rather the one with the white background and the big red cross.
Yep.
The one that, alas, for many years was rather associated with English nationalism, a trend that was supercharged during the Brexit campaign.
Indeed. It's a tricky one because today the St. George's flag is most definitely associated with English national sports teams, but while St. George's Day can have positive associations, it has also been embraced by the likes of the English Defence League and other quite sinister right-wing groups. So there can be a bit of an awkward underbelly to it at times.
There sure can be, making poor St. George a bit of a divisive figure in some quarters. Unlike Shakespeare, who absolutely everybody loves without exception.
Well,
he was not just of an age, Martin, but for all time.
Sure. Okay. Anyway, happy St. George's Day for tomorrow, everyone. And if you see a princess being threatened by a dragon, do the right thing and save her. That's the kind of chivalrous act we expect from members of the Three Ravens community.
So should we deter the county criers from embarking on a whole new crusade and have them ring us into Suffolk?
I think we should. Now, come on, you lot. The Middle East is in quite the pickle without you sticking your beaks in. Why are you dressed as a dragon? This podcast's meant to be a professional outfit.
Hey, 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 hey,
hey, hey,
gather round.
Oh, yeah.
Suffolk is located in East Anglia. It's bordered by Norfolk to the north, Cambridgeshire to the west, Essex to the south, and the North Sea to the east. As always, there's a map showing its precise location and a blog all about the county on our website at threeravenspodcast.com.
But there's also our online shop. Don't forget the shop. Three Ravens merch, it's there for you.
Indeed. Now, as mentioned earlier, on Saturday we'll be releasing our interview with our local legend for Suffolk, author, storyteller, museum curator, and all-round good egg, Kirsty Hartziotis. And I thought, as part of our conversation, I would ask Kirsty to try to summarise Suffolk from her unique perspective.
Okay, so for listeners who don't know Suffolk, we've been talking about it, you know, in general terms. But if you were to be the ambassador to describe what Suffolk is like, I mean, how would you describe the county to somebody who's never been?
Oh, that's a difficult one. I mean, it's kind of in my blood. For me, I'm always drawn to the sea. So let's whip straight across Suffolk, first of all, to start from the coast. It has, of course, got its beautiful Sheeshe beaches at Southwold and Warberswick. But if you start at the top from Covehithe, and I don't think you're even allowed to walk there at the moment because the cliff is collapsing, you have that sense of precariousness of the landscape, of sand dunes and marshes running along the coast that gives you an idea of non-permanence. Because as you say, Dunwich was washed away, and seemingly even today, bits of Suffolk are being drifted down to Essex, is most unfair. But then in the heart of the county, you have this fantastic land that is good for farming, and you have a great agrarian community. But it also used to be a place with a lot of cattle farming. Did you know that? I didn't know that. And this quite well off county with its wonderful wool churches that speaks of a place that was rich during the Middle Ages, that gives us fantastic buildings to look at, but then became poorer. Now, Suffolk and Norfolk as well have always been at the forefront of agricultural reform. So now you have these massive fields that are very different from the hedgerow fields of my childhood. But these are little places where stories easily grow up amongst the half-timbered, pink-painted architecture and these very rich churches in the heart of their communities, and pubs, many pubs. Many of the folk tales talk about pubs and how you can hear stories in pubs that you probably shouldn't believe.
A very beautiful description of Suffolk from Kirsty there.
Isn't it? And I like that she mentioned the pink houses.
Yes, as discussed last year, the pink colour of the houses in Suffolk was originally achieved by adding lime wash to oxblood, sloe berries, elderberries and blackthorn to include the protective influences of the local plants.
It's not just pretty, it's magic.
Absolutely. But also, Kirsty's brief description draws out some quite important themes to do with the county, not least that sense of the sea and that blending together of amazing medieval churches and big heritage with a kind of melancholy almost,
yeah,
which is definitely related to ideas like impermanence and erosion.
Exactly right. And of course, last year, your episode about Suffolk addressed many of those themes with your original telling of the Wild Man of Orford and lots of other big hitter bits of history and folklore. I won't repeat them, apart from to say that they included things like Roger Bigod, Southwold, the Anglo-Dutch Wars, the Green Children of Wool Pit, which is a really important story, the Marsh Demons of Icon, the Rendlesham UFO incident. There's tons, but Loads we missed out.
It's the way with Three Ravens. We kind of dip into the grab bag, don't we?
We do. Anyhow, during your episode about Suffolk, you spoke about Ipswich, Suffolk's county town, its geography and its Anglo-Saxon past.
Sutton who?
Sutton what?
Sutton who?
Sutton where?
Sutton who?
I could keep going, but maybe we should stop there. Or should we? Sutton how?
Sutton who?
Okay, genuinely, enough now. Although, as I discuss with Kirsty in our full conversation, along with other bits of folklore, in the last few weeks, it has been announced that they are now planning new digs at Sutton who because they think there might be more Anglo-Saxon wonders under the earth there yet to be discovered.
Sutton when? And Sutton why?
Well, as we know, a big old ship burial was found at Sutton who containing the remains and grave goods of King Redwald. At least, we think they're the remains of Redwald. If you want to see the artifacts themselves, they are mostly at the British Museum with some pieces plus replicas at Sutton who in Suffolk itself. And basically, the consensus has become that not only are there a ton of other burial mounds at Sutton who that they want to reassess with modern technology, but there's a theory now that the whole area could be a bit of an Anglo-Saxon burial complex.
Oh, wow. I really hope they find new things. What we already have is jaw-droppingly amazing.
Yeah.
But imagine if there's more.
Yeah, well, I'm imagining. And considering the impact the first set of discoveries had, if they find more, it could reshape our entire understanding of Anglo-Saxon life, or at the very least, our understanding of Anglo-Saxon Suffolk. But that's all news hot off the press. If we scooch back in time, one of the things you didn't speak much about last year was the impact of the Normans on Suffolk.
Yes, I did speak a little bit about Framlingham Castle.
You did.
But you're right, it's not something I spent much time discussing.
Well, that's probably because while Suffolk, the county's name literally meaning southern folk, by the way, but Suffolk as a county pre-existed the Norman invasion, it had just been formed as a kingdom. But once the Normans came along, they combined Suffolk with Norfolk into one big block with the capital at Dunwich, although they built strongholds at Eye, Clare, Walton and Framlingham, which you mentioned. That's in addition to the previous Anglo-Saxon strongholds at Sudbury and Ipswich. So in their way, the Normans had a huge impact on the geography of Suffolk.
Kind of wild to think about that, actually, isn't it? The idea that this invading force can kind of come in and not completely redraw the map, but also create a series of towns which sprang up around their castles.
It is absolutely bananas. And it's maybe worth noting that the administrative block of Norfolk and Suffolk together, so East Anglia as we might call it, lasted right up until 1575 and the reign of Elizabeth I.
Wow, so that's 5 centuries.
Yep, pretty much 5 centuries. And we're not quite 5 centuries on from their splitting, which is also a bit bonkers. And although they sort of pale in significance to the beauty and wonder of Framlingham Castle and the amazing folklore and strangeness of Orford Castle, you can still visit the ruins of Eye Castle, as well as Burr Castle outside Gorston-on-Sea, Bygod Castle in Bungay, Wheating Castle in Thetford Forest. There's quite a few bits of stone still standing from that Norman period of construction. And it's also important to remember that before the Normans, Suffolk and Norfolk were both badly impacted by Danish incursions.
Ah, yes, the Danelaw.
Indeed. We've spoken a bit about the Danelaw before. This was where England was split, sort of diagonally down the middle by Danish invaders, and everyone threatened by the Danes had to pay Dane geld, meaning Dane gold, so a form of tax. And this tax was paid over in mainland Europe as well.
It kind of functioned like gangsters charging protection money.
Yeah.
You know, hey, you got a nice town here. Would be shame if something bad happened to it. But me and my guys, hey, we could make sure that never happens.
Yeah, exactly. And being right on England's eastern tip, it made sense that Suffolk was very much within the Danish side of the nation.
Well, the Danelaw stretched right down to London, didn't it? With all of East Anglia inside.
It sure did. And actually, during the Danelaw, East Anglia was in the same kingdom as London. That was the Kingdom of Guthrum, which ended on the northern side, all along the border which ran down the River Great Ouse, which flows all the way through Buckinghamshire, Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire and Norfolk to drain into the Wash and the North Sea near King's Lynn.
That's a massive area of the country.
Yep.
And who was Guthrum? Do we know much about him?
He was an Anglo-Saxon king who helped establish the Dane law, who was ultimately defeated by Alfred the Great, but who lived to fight another day, becoming baptised as a Christian. Afterwards, he was known as Athelstan.
Not the Athelstan, though.
No, not the Athelstan, son of Edward the Elder, the so-called greatest of the Anglo-Saxon kings. Seems like Athelstan was just a popular name at the time. A bit like Jim or Bob or Steve.
Can you imagine rocking up to primary school today being called Athelstan? Nobody would come for your lunch money for fear you might take their entire family hostage.
Hey, nice cheese strings you got there, buddy. Be ashamed if something happened to one. Now, I think it's a name that needs a revival. Anyway, post-Normans, we also didn't mention last time some of the monastic ruins in Suffolk, including Leyston Abbey, which was moved in 1363 from a previous boggy location to where its ruins still stand. Quite the spectacular place and well worth a look, managed by English Heritage. Plus, there's the quite limited but nonetheless rather important ruins of the Abbey of St. Edmund at Bury St. Edmunds, which was once one of the richest, largest and most powerful Benedictine monasteries in all of England.
Both wrecked, of course, by Henry VIII.
Yeah, stinky old Henry VIII with his festering leg and crazy brain. Still, the remains of the Abbey of St. Edmunds is now mostly part of a boarding school, but you can still visit the Abbey Gardens and see some of what remains. Oh, also, last time, we didn't mention Helmingham Hall.
Helmingham Hall is a crazy place. What an architectural gem.
Most definitely. Begun in 1480, it's a private residence, so you can't normally go inside, although the gardens are open during the summer and are proper gorgeous. But the main thing that's jaw-dropping about Helmingham Hall is that the present house, which dates from 1510, with Georgian updates in the late 18th century, is that it's surrounded on all sides by a 60-foot moat with two working drawbridges.
It's bonkers. And as per usual, we'll put pictures on social media and on the blog. But I think I'm right in saying that it's said every night since 1510, the drawbridges at Helmingham Hall have been raised and then they're lowered again in the morning.
Which has created challenges for generations of postmen. And in addition to its amazing gardens, it also has a 400-acre deer park out the back. So if you like red and fallow deer, it's a great place to go and see some deer sort of deering about.
Who doesn't like red deer, though? Mm. I mean, really, what glorious creatures. They also have a sculpture trail, don't they?
They
so when
do.
You drive past, you can often see quite amazing grand-scale artwork.
It's definitely a place worth going to. And while there is more history to talk about, I've written quite a long story this week, so we'll bank that for our next bite at the Suffolk cherry so we can move on to folklore. But before we do, it's time for another new segment. County dishes.
Yes, this came out of our Three Ravens first birthday live stream chat, which is available to watch on YouTube. But as part of that conversation, one of the things members of the Three Ravens community said they wanted us to include was cookery.
Yeah, Eleanor threatened to turn this into an entire cookery program on YouTube until I protested. But we thought it would be very possible to talk about recipes or famous dishes from the counties. So here we go.
I am so excited. All right, Martin, what's our traditional Suffolk dish?
Well, this is an 11th century pudding from Suffolk called the Suffolk Kitchell, also known as the God's Kitchell.
Kitchell?
Yeah, K-I-T-C-H-E-L. It comes from the Anglo-Saxon word kucha, meaning cake, and it was said to be a kind of luncheon food, a bit like a Cornish pasty.
Only sweet.
Yeah, it's sweet. We'll put the full recipe on the blog and on social media, but the idea is you take mixed dried fruit, perhaps soaked in alcohol if you like. You then stir that into melted butter with crushed and ground almonds and let it cool. You then roll out pastry. Today the recommendation is that you use puff pastry, and you then spoon your buttered fruits and nuts onto the pastry, fold it over and pinch the edges closed. You can then finish it with an egg wash before baking. But here's the important bit.
The important bit?
Yeah, because before baking you need to make three cuts in the top of the pastry. One for the Father, one for the Son, and one for the Holy Spirit.
Which is why I'm guessing it's called a God's Kitchell.
Exactly. And then you can obviously dust the top with sugar as well and bake it for about about half an hour, after which you'll have a portable parcel of pastry full of energy, blessed by the Lord for looking after your sheep or managing your fields or fishing off the Suffolk coast.
Well, it's my turn to cook dinner tonight, so I'd better get cracking. It sounds delicious.
As we said before, we'll make the full recipe available on social media and the blog. So if you make a Suffolk kitchel, be sure to send us pictures or videos or tag us in your posts.
And now, folklore.
Yes, so I promised some things at the top of the show, one of which was to talk about the Wizard of Ipswich.
And who the heck was the Wizard of Ipswich?
Well, he was a man known very evocatively as Old Winter. We have records of his doings dating from the mid-1700s, where he lived in a house on Foundation Street in Ipswich, Suffolk's county town.
It has a medieval history, Ipswich. It used to be called Yipperswick, which rather amusingly means Cheetah's Emporium or Swindler's Market.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
I mean, it should still be called Swindler's Market. What a thing to see on a sign. Right? I would love that.
But Old Winter, he's a proper folkloric character, part local bogeyman, part local hero, and there are quite a few adventures associated with him. For example, in the 19th century book Some Materials for the History of Worsted by Foster Barham Zink, there are reports of witnesses seeing Old Winter with a half dozen black imps on his table, the size of rats or bats, talking to him, or rather twittering. The theory goes they did his bidding.
Excellent stuff. Well done, Old Winter.
Yep, and there's another tale where he manages to hypnotise a thief who people suspect of stealing their timber. The consequences for the thief are that he ends up walking round and around a field carrying all the wood he's stolen until he's near death, at which point Old Winter frees him from the curse. That one comes from famous Suffolk chronicler Arthur Hollingsworth. But the best one involves the time Old Winter made a witch spontaneously combust.
Hold on a minute. He made a witch catch fire.
Yep. The woman's name, we know this, was Grace Pett. And the basic idea of the story was, one day a farmer came to see Old Winter saying his sheep had been bewitched. They were acting strangely, trying to break through the fences he'd built and run away, not responding to his calls or his dog. So Old Winter oversaw the burning of one of the sheep, with Winter's theory going back to that old bit of cunning lore that any spell you cast on another might come back to you threefold.
And is that what happened to Grace Pett?
It did indeed. The farmer's neighbour, Grace Pett, was at home while Old Winter and the farmer burned the sheep. This happened in 1744, and as they burned the bewitched sheep, boom, Grace Pett burst into flames and died, freeing the other sheep from the curse she'd laid upon them.
I feel like Grace didn't perhaps deserve that, even if she was getting into a bit of sheep rustling.
Yeah, perhaps not.
But very interesting about Old Winter, and he was definitely a real person.
Oh yeah, a real person. He was said to have learned his hedge wisdom from a previous cunning man in Ipswich, that he travelled as far as Oldborough, and we don't seem to know how he died, so maybe he never did.
Love it.
Next up, let's talk Suffolk punches.
Yes, they're not what they sound like.
No, they are nothing to do with boxing or an otherwise forgotten form of East Anglian martial arts, and they are not a delicious fruity cocktail to be enjoyed at a 70s-style party. Oh no, they are, in fact, a breed of horse.
Not just any breed of horse, the oldest English breed of horse ever.
Yep.
Literally the first.
Exactly right. First recorded in 1586 and also known as a Suffolk sorrel, they are very big horses, the kind which for centuries became synonymous with farm work across England. They are meant to be, by temperament, very dedicated, calm horses with enormous stamina. And until recently, you used to be able to learn all about them at maybe the most fabulously named museum ever.
Martin speaks here of the Woodbridge Heavy Horse Museum.
That's right, an entire museum dedicated to heavy horses. Now, the Heavy Horse Museum no longer exists, but you can still visit it in its new form, the Suffolk Punch Trust, which is a working stud farm in Suffolk with exhibits about the history of these sensational chestnut brown horses, which weigh, on average, An entire ton.
That is the equivalent of many cars.
Yeah, double the weight of a regular thoroughbred horse, and a fully grown elephant weighs between 2 and 4 tons. So when we say that these are heavy horses, we mean it.
Presumably it's on account of all the Suffolk kitchens they've been gobbling.
Maybe. Still, at the start of the episode, I said we'd answer the question, what to do if a farmer gives you a Suffolk punch? It shouldn't hurt unless it's dropped on top of you.
In which case, you be dead.
Yeah. So, otherwise, you should say thank you very much, give the horse a carrot or a sugar cube, and get ploughing.
You also said you were going to tell us where to go to summon the devil in Suffolk.
I did, and I realise there's still tons of Suffolk folklore we've not addressed, some of which I'll talk about with Kirsty on this week's Local Legends, but... you know how we discovered during the first series that in the east of England, there's far fewer fairy stories than there are in the west?
Yes.
Well, here's what Kirsty had to say about that in particular.
Although I do have a lot of admiration for our Victorian fellows for what they did. I mean, I'm thinking of the Reverend Hollingsworth in Stowmarket.
Yes. And
literally, there's 2 pages at the back of his big book about his big bumper book of Stowmarket, which tells you all of the history of Stowmarket that you could possibly want to read. And I haven't read it, but I have read those 2 pages at the back where, for some reason, he is quite early at recording fairy lore. And so Stowmarket, you'd say, oh, well, Suffolk, there's not actually that many stories of fairies. But they're all in Stowmarket. So you've got the story of the man who hosts a fairy meeting in his house and they tidy up after him. You've got the quite spooky stories of the fairies that could be seen at certain areas in around where brick production was in Stowmarket. Most of these places completely gone. Stowmarket has had a lot of development. And then the most chilling one of all for me is the story of the woman who nearly loses her baby. She sees the child being taken and the steel pins, so not safety pins, but just pins that are pinning the baby's nappy on, being pulled out one by one by these little tiny sandy folk. So these are very diminutive fairies, the kind of size of fairies that we tend to imagine, as opposed to the more usual folkloric fairy, which is about the size of a 7 or 8 year old child, yeah. Or the great masterful fairies of the Celtic world, who are, if not as tall as us, if not they're bigger, grander, more beautiful, more everything. But these are little fairies and they're stealing babies away. And it turns out that this baby, who's nearly stolen, but is grabbed back by her mother, is the one who's telling the story to Reverend Hollingsworth. She's the sister of the sexton, and she and the sexton, so this brother and sister, have all of these fairy stories. And they tell another story, I don't know, it's from a different person, I think, and Reverend Hollingsworth, of a changeling, of a child. They're actually quite positive, these fairy stories. So you've got the guy who got money for letting the fairies have a party in his house, but you've also got the woman who looked after a fairy changeling when the changeling came to her, who grieved her own child, who was taken into the fairy world, but who nonetheless cared for and looked after the new baby and was paid a shilling by the fairies for her pain.
Very reasonable rate.
Very reasonable rate. It certainly would have been, because most of these stories are not from the 1850s. These are probably stories from the late 18th century, because they're remembered from the childhoods of the older people who are in their 70s, maybe 80s. Certainly the sister of the sexton is about 80. That's recorded in those 2 pages of lore.
Super interesting. That sounds like it's going to be a brilliant conversation.
Oh, it absolutely is. Like you, Eleanor, Kirsty was a Suffolk native. And although she moved about across the borders between Norfolk, Cambridgeshire and Suffolk, she's an absolute font of knowledge when it comes to local lore and stories. Plus, she's an expert on the arts and crafts movement. She's a museum curator. Absolutely fascinating human being. So please check out the episode when it comes out. But for now, and before I tell my story, let's talk about the devil.
Yes, well, we know that Suffolk is generally bothered by lots of devilish creatures, not least the very many black dogs and shucks that appear across the county's history.
Most definitely. And there are loads of devil legends in the county, including tales at Exning, Stoneham Aspall, South Elm St James and others. But the most evocative has to be the Devil's Stone at St Mary's Church in Bungay.
That very church where on 4th of August 1577, Black Shuck burst through the doors like a clap of thunder.
The one and same. And maybe because of Shuck, this cool legend has been criminally overlooked. Specifically, there's a very old stone in the churchyard, which is also known as the Druid Stone.
I've never paid attention.
Well, it's near the west door, and there are other druidy pagan bits of stonework in Suffolk, including a pretty evocative carved face that's set in the porch of St Lawrence's Church in Ilkeshall that's pre-Roman, and it's generally believed that St Mary's Church is one of a few churches in Suffolk that used to be pagan and perhaps a druidic temple.
Well, this is exciting.
It sure is. Anyway, what's particularly interesting about the Devil's Stone or Druid Stone at St Mary's is that forms of stone worship back in the pre-Roman era used to involve processions around sacred stones, as we know, and the striking of stones, with some stones creating sparks when struck.
So is this stone one of those?
It is. A stone that, if struck, will produce sparks. This isn't all that remarkable, really, but it's also said, on a full moon, if you dance around the Devil's Stone at St Mary's Churchyard 12 times and strike a spark on it 12 times, then the devil will appear.
So a magic pagan rock in a churchyard, which used to be a druidic temple, and it's the same churchyard where Black Shuck appeared.
Is it all just a coincidence, or is there a special association between everybody's favourite hellhound and the mysterious pagan past?
Well, when we're in Bungay for Black Shuck Festival from the 2nd to the 4th of August this year, performing in our plays The Wild Man of Orford and Black Shuck, we will have to run some experiments.
Yeah, I checked. It's actually a new moon on the 4th of August 2024. Full moon is either July the 21st or August the 19th. But hey, no harm in trying.
There's potentially enormous harm in trying. We could summon the devil himself to go to Mendy's.
He'd be a great guest for local legends, though, wouldn't he? I bet he knows a few stories.
True.
Anyway, speaking of stories, it is story time. And as promised, it's my telling of the Rat Piper of Beccles. Only forewarned is forearmed. I've gone for a silly telling this week as we're talking about silly Suffolk. I hope it makes you laugh, and I'll start spinning my yarn right after this.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
If you have ever seen a baby rat, you'll know that they're sweet-looking things. Like red raw fingers, wrinkled and blind, they cluster together like the fists of blind hands. And when a baby, a rat's ears are tiny, its tail is short, and its eyes are as closed as a well-kept secret. Perhaps it's for this reason that the confusion occurred back in the plague year of 1349. The Black Death, as we call it, had long ravaged our cousins across the sea, and with earthquakes in Italy strong enough to shake the teacups all the way over in the court of Edward III, it was thought by many that the apocalypse had come. The Hundred Years' War stopped, for the plague was killing soldiers quicker than they could kill one another. And, aside from a few Teutonic knights riding about making trouble, the nations, cities, and towns of Europe took to looking inwards instead of out. For the plague came to England the year previous, in 1348, crossing the sea on the backs of rats. And you can't blame the rats for this one, it was hardly their fault. But from Melcombe in Devon to London and on, it ravaged the rich and the poor alike. Spare a thought, perhaps, for Joan of Navarre, the Queen of Bones, laid low by the spread of the thing. Yet she was rich, and a necromancer, as everyone knows, while by 1349, not a person in Suffolk was left untouched by its ravages. Men, women, children, and all were dying in droves, making rats the kings of the county. Many a village vanished in the Black Death, drowned beneath that flood of sickness, sadness, and despair. And in Suffolk, the Breckland village of Wordwell was just one such place. 18 families once called it home, over 100 people, though once the plague was done, only one of those souls remained. And she was a baby, newly born, barely hatched from her mother's belly before she was orphaned, just one day old. And that's the thing about baby humans. They, too, are sweet-looking things. And although perhaps not much like a finger, you can see how the rats got confused. Or perhaps they weren't confused at all, for rats are cunning beasts. Still, that girl, motherless, fatherless, brother and sisterless, soon found herself nestled in a pink clump of rats, growing and thriving and scampering pretty well before long. Blackleg, the king of the rats of Suffolk, took a particular liking to the girl, for though she was slower than the rest of the rats, and bigger, and hungrier, and without a tail, and with no teeth at all to begin with, he appreciated all of her pinkness. And though Blackleg was king, so was every rat in Suffolk. For rats have very high opinions of themselves, and each one you meet will declare themselves lord of all they survey, which is why, if you disturb a group of them, they're prone to skitter and scatter and each go their own way. Sometimes they agree, but with so many kings, the only rats who really have sway in the average nest, warren, or riverside hole are the big ones, and Blackleg was enormous. He was also a rare sort of rat, for he had, as you might have guessed, a black leg. Rat naming conventions are not complex. Like we have so many Williams and Johns, Olivias and Lilies, rats have many gnawers and big ears, biters and long tails. Word has it that there was once a rat called Terry, which was very novel, but that was likely just a scurrilous rumour made up by a rat with imagination. As for the language of rats, it is called simply rat. And though there are dialects from Spain to Cairo, New York to Mumbai, all of them are basically the same. A combination of squeaks, chirps, and hisses. Most people can't hear them and rarely think to listen. But the girl, raised amongst them almost from birth, was fluent. She chittered and cooed, squealed and sang like the best of them. In fact, so sweet was her voice that Blackleg and his kin came to call her Birdie, after the winged creatures of the trees, sky and air, with whom the rats had an uneasy alliance. Of course, it did become clear in time that Birdie was not a rat. Not technically, at least, for she was very person-shaped, increasingly so as the years went on. But in spirit, she was ratty as anything. Crafty, quick, an excellent climber, she hid like the best of them and was anything but a fussy eater, which was handy in the years after the plague first came, for people starved and went hungry, and crops rotted in the fields, for there were no farmers left to harvest them. Which is how, in the first decade of Birdie's life, that Blackleg and his fellow swarm of long-tailed scoundrels learned to use Birdie. For though they could burrow, nibble, and clamber their way into places she could not, she could open doors, drag sacks of grain, or pick up entire cooking pots from the tops of unwatched stoves. It seemed there was nothing they could not achieve when they worked together. The rats going first, scoping out a farmhouse or grand hall, then dispatching Birdie to lead the raid. That was until one day when they tried to rob the wrong house. To call the building a house was, in fact, a little generous. Seeing it from a distance, you might call it a cottage, but truly, it was a hovel. Shared by three sisters, the rats thought they could play the usual game, scouring the stores and kitchen by night, leaving it bare and disappearing into the shadows. Alas, the sisters in question had a cat, a wily creature named Samson, who roved all about the county in a manner most uncat-like. If you visit the church in Aldborough, for example, there's a carving of him there on the end of a pew, made on account of his having attended a number of church services in his latter years, mostly to laugh at the wrongness of the priests. For, as you might have guessed, Samson was not really a cat, and the three sisters were not really women. Indeed, between Bockagrop, the toad, and an old ferret called Mirth, the trio of witches and their animal spirits were well known locally as people from whom it was rather unwise to steal. So it was that one night, when aged almost 10 years old, Birdie snuck into the witch's home and found herself caught pink-handed. "And what do we have here?" said Mirth, scuttling over a table overflowing with pots and pans, herbs and potions, and half a wheel of cheese.
"It's a girl!"
croaked Bockagrop, who had watched Birdie enter through the front door and creep on silent paws towards the pantry.
"Oh, that's no girl," said Samson, who had a great deal of experience in such matters. "That's a rat in a girl's body. I could smell her from a mile off."
Samson was not lying when he said this, for not only did he have a very acute olfactory sense for a demon, but also in her many long years of life, Birdie had never washed. She had seen bathtubs and considered them very suspicious, and probably best used not as a means of getting clean, yuck, but instead as something to ride inside, down steep slopes, especially when it snowed. "Well," Mirth continued, "I suppose we should wake the sisters."
"Oh, don't," Bockagrop replied. "They're having cheese dreams, wild premonitions. Who knows what hidden mysteries they might reveal?"
"I suppose," Samson said decisively, "it's not like she's going anywhere. We can eat her in the morning." The imp licked his lips, knowing he'd not eaten a girl-sized rat before, but liking the idea very much. As for why Birdie could not move, she had, unlike her ratty friends, stumbled into a hex. For, though the witches that lived in the cottage didn't much like rats sneaking in and pinching morsels from their larder, setting endless spells to stop them doing so was arduous work. People were another matter, and so Red Nance, one of the three sisters, had spun a person-sized magical spiderweb all through the kitchen. Nance and her sisters, Blind Sally and Fanny No Teeth, were excepted from its glutinous barbs, but Birdie was not. Like a fly, she was pinioned, glued there until daybreak. When the new day dawned, Red Nance, Blind Sally, and Fanny No Teeth variously woke, broke wind, complained about their hair being in terrible tangles, and then found Birdie. "A girl-shaped rat, you say?" Red Nance muttered to Samson, stroking her beard. "Such pungency!" Blind Sally exclaimed, almost in admiration.
"I think she's interesting," said Fanny No Teeth, looking Birdie up and down. "A little orphan, I'd wager, raised by rats. Sisters, we are living in strange times indeed, though no doubt she would be delicious."
"Especially if we roast her," Blind Sally added, licking her lips. "She's already marinated in herself."
"Yes, yes, but we three know how it is to be a young woman making your way in the world. We could teach her."
Red Nance gave Birdie a look up and down and round about and decided she didn't hate the idea. And so it was that the three sisters showed Birdie how to be a lady. Not that Birdie ever truly wanted to be a lady, but rather they showed her how to pretend. Red Nance taught her how to speak human, as she called it, which was English, of course, and how to dance jigs and perform cartwheels and handstands. Fanny No Teeth showed her how to cook things in a cauldron for herself, as well as how to find and prepare particular herbs, how to tickle a salmon into wanting to be caught, and how to trick foxes, hares, badgers, and owls. For if you know how to trick those particular creatures, you can trick anyone or anything. All the while, Blackleg and his noble compatriots watched and learned too. They could not speak human on account of having the wrong sorts of voice boxes, tongues and teeth, but they sat on the witch's garden fence or hid in the weeds or peered through the windows of the hovel at the goings on within. "You ask me," Blackleg said from time to time, watching Birdie chopping with a knife or trying on a new dress or pair of shoes. "Birdie needs none of this. We were doing just fine without these witches." "Oh, Blackleg," said Nibbler. "I say, as King of Rats, that the more she knows, the more mighty we will be. For she, as such a large and pinkish rat, with all these new powers, can lead our armies to untold riches." "You, the King of Rats," said Blackleg. "Pull the other one. It's got bells on."
"Who's saying they're the King of Rats?" said One Ear. "Because I'm the King of Rats, as everybody knows."
Quite often, discussions like these would break down into lots of scurrying, the lashing of tails, and occasionally a bit of bitey, scratchy, rough and tumble. And sometimes Samson or Mirth would appear, intending to eat one or more of the rats, which led to great escapades. Rats flooding this way and that, leading the familiars in a merry chase all about the witch's yard. That was until Blind Sally taught Birdie her lessons. The first of these was fighting, obviously, including punching, kicking, kneeing, biting, the pulling of hair and eye gouging, an important and often overlooked martial strategy, as epitomised when Blind Sally lost her eyes in a scrap with the Orwell Mermaid. The second lesson was how to spit, not perhaps essential knowledge, but good fun nonetheless. Their last lesson, though, was the important one, for Blind Sally taught Birdie how to play the flute. The particular flute they used comes from another story, but after its previous owners, a goldsmith, a tallow chandler, and a peddler, had sold their souls to the devil and ended up dragged down to hell, it technically no longer had an owner. And so Blind Sally had taken to tooting on it from time to time and showed Birdie how. The effects of this decision were wide-ranging. For the three sisters, it was cheering. They liked to hear Birdie's music. It made the hours go faster. Household chores seemed fun. And it seemed also that, although Birdie was not technically a witch, they could hear in her playing a kind of magic. For the familiars, too, it was something uncanny. Being demons and creatures of darkness, they weren't normally prone to like pretty things, be those sights, sounds, smells, or flavours, but even they could not resist. Bocca Grob took to croaking along and hopping up and down so his belly would slap on the ground percussively in time. Mirth used the washboard, scuttling up and down it with his claws and rubbing his rump against its grooves, adding a singular bassy timbre. Samson, meanwhile, yowled and meowed and pushed things off the edge of tables with glee, sometimes as part of the music, sometimes just for larks. Most profound of all, however, was the effect on the rats, for when Birdie played, the rats took arms with one another, swayed back and forth, swung their tails about, and, perhaps more significant than anything else, they stopped bickering, which was how, in time, Birdie ended up hatching a plan. "You know, dearest Blackleg," Birdie said one day, "I've come up with a ruse."
"Tell me more, sweet daughter," Blackleg replied, his whiskers twitching. After years of waiting, he was excited to discover if there would be any benefit at all to the witch's lessons, beyond Birdie playing the flute, and perhaps the spitting, which Blackleg thought most wonderful.
Well, Birdie said, it goes a little bit like this. Birdie's plan was inspired and all agreed. So it was that in 1361, when Birdie was no longer a girl and very much a young woman, she and the rats bade a fond farewell to Red Nance, who by then was going grey, even if nobody mentioned it, as well as Blind Sally, Fanny No Teeth, Samson, Bockagrop, and Mirth. They then enacted their plan, which went as so. Just like when Birdie had been a child, the rats would go first, invading a town like Scotchmere between Bury St Edmunds and Thetford, or Chilton near Sudbury, Aigthorpe near Lowestoft, on and on. Plagued with rats and with the local people already dying of the great mortality, buboes sprouting from armpits, crotches and neck crevices like potatoes in garden rows, the people would need a saviour. Enter Birdie, the rat piper, like the legendary flutist of Hamelin a century before, who led 130 children away up into the Piemont Mountains, never to be seen again. She would offer to liberate a village or town of its rat infestation. I can save you, of course, Birdie would say, fingering the holes on her instrument. And not a rat will remain, but the price will be dear, for I will take all your gold and silver and half the food in your stores. Now, this may seem like a steep price, but as you'll likely be aware, most 14th century Suffolk villages weren't exactly overflowing with silver and gold. If they were lucky, Birdie and the rats would get away with a special commemorative cup or a few coins. The real treat, though, was the food, which was more than enough to feed the ever-growing swarm of rats and for Birdie to make something fancier for herself using a cauldron. And as for Birdie's cauldron, it was bought from a woman called Margaret Lupe and dug up in Branford in 1992. It's currently at the British Museum. Of course, the people of Scotchmere, Chilton and Aigthorpe all had their doubts. They would suck their teeth and grumble, and in response, Birdie would give a very impressive spit, then play a few notes. Duly, the rats would assemble neatly in lines and jig back and forth in time. Blackleg would lead proceedings, stepping rhythmically and raising and lowering his paws in complex choreographed sequences. The other rats would follow, some carrying bits of twig they would clack together, some twirling lengths of ribbon or twine. Indeed, after Chilton, Blackleg acquired a small pewter bell which Birdie tied to his tail, adding a certain je ne sais quoi. Amazed, disturbed, and sometimes a little disgusted, various town elders, mayors, priests, and their wives would then assent to Birdie's terms. Some even fell to their knees and prayed, which felt a bit much, but Birdie wasn't complaining. For once the terms were agreed and shaken upon, she would then put her lips to the flute, play a happy song, and the rats would follow behind, cavorting and spinning, skipping and squeaking, all the way out into the countryside. And sometimes the people of the villages would follow, so Birdie, wisely, would lead the army of rats to some sort of nearby bridge, and the rats would jump in. Some dived head first, some belly flopped, some tucked their back paws in and under so they would land tail down and make a very large, splashy cannonball. Either way, they would surge downstream as if washed away, and Birdie would then accept payment. Before long, she'd bought herself a very nice horse called Bernard, and a wagon to hitch to his back, and a few spare frocks, some summer shoes, and a hairbrush. All told, she and the rats were rather pleased with themselves, and by night, when they would rendezvous, usually in some sort of secluded wood nearby, cheers went up. Birdie would light a fire to help the rats dry out, and they all snuggled up together in the back of the wagon with the stars out and all at peace with the world. They had no complaints. Plenty to eat, excellent company, and Birdie's music to cheer one and all. I say all, but the only one not cheered in all this was, alas, Birdie herself, for while the rats had each other and she had the rats, she did feel a little lonely. The witches who helped raise her had two sisters each for company, plus they had familiars to match. And though Blackleg would curl up on Birdie's chest to go to sleep, or make a nest in her hair and sometimes tell her bedtime stories, normally about improbably large sausages he'd like to eat, there was an emptiness somewhere inside. Not an absence of cheer per se, but a space in her overall cheer reserve that she worried would forever remain unfilled. Then, though, things went wrong. And the reason things went wrong was the people of Beccles. If you don't know Beccles, it's a market town, and these days rather charming. Famous for being the place where Horatio Nelson was born. It's on the banks of the Waveney, and is one of those very old places that existed before England was England. Perhaps because of its ancient heritage, though perhaps also because the people of the town were dying of plague, in the 14th century, the folk of Beccles were generally unwelcoming to outsiders. There was a pub, the Bear and Bells, which stands to this day on the square, and even then they offered a very nice ploughman's lunch, but only to the locals. When strangers neared, the sign on the door would turn to closed. Folk shuttered their windows, locked their doors audibly, and coughed and spluttered and tried not to die while they tutted about pesky outsiders. When the rats arrived in their grey-brown swarm, as you can imagine, the people of Beccles were unamused. The baker found them in his flour, the miller in his barrels of grain, the brewer swimming in his ale. The shepherd found them snuggled in his bales of wool. The dressmaker caught them holding up swatches of fabric, as if asking, "Do you think this one matches my eyes?" And the milliner was positively incensed when he spied a number of his best coifs scuttling out the door, each won by a half dozen rats, all working in teams. Steamingly angry, the people of Beccles called for the mayor, Mr. Peck. And Mr. Peck, who was generally a miserly man, yet who ate and drank like the best of them, waddled down the streets, speaking to the fuming, diseased, and dying populace, assuring them all would be well. "Dearest people of Beccles," he declared, "fear not, we've had rats before and we'll have them again. There may be many of them, but this is not a problem, it's an opportunity. Do as you normally would, set traps, lay poison, loose your feline companions. And if you do, before long, this entire rat problem will be solved." A crowd gathered as he spoke, emitting mutters of doubt and discontent, but Mr. Peck, with his daughter Anne by his side, was undeterred. "They are only rats," he said. "Nothing you fine people can't handle." "We need outside expertise," said Baxter Lound, a Fletcher who was itching at the bulge on his throat. "Use some of the taxes we pay to bring in a rat catcher, an honest-to-goodness specialist." "Someone with experience," said Ashby Cowlinge, who was only 10, but on account of his mother, father, brother, and three aunts having died, he was now head of his household. "Oh, father," whispered Anne, standing by her dad, "I do think this feels rather different." And it did feel different. Even as the people of Beccles stood in a cluster, they watched a swarm of rats carrying a scarecrow down the middle of the road. Quite what the creatures intended to do with it, none knew, but matters were evidently getting out of hand. "Nonsense," Mr. Peck replied. "I have absolute faith in you all. Self-determination, that's what we're about in Beccles, aren't we? Freedom and self-determination. And remember, taxes are due on Friday. Also, if anyone would like to marry Anne, as previously mentioned, she's on the market. I'm looking at you, John Woodward. Make me an offer. You know where I live." Anne, who was a shy and unassuming young woman, looked at John Woodward and mulled him over. A capable enough carpenter with a huge barrel chest, he was tall and strong and brave and handsome. He had been kicked in the head by a donkey in his youth, so wasn't much of a conversationalist, but she could imagine worse husbands. Truth be told, though, she'd always thought she'd marry someone a little bit more exciting, someone with a sense of adventure, perhaps from outside Beccles. Alas, with most of the eligible bachelors in the county being dead, she figured beggars could not be choosers, and that if John Woodward had saved enough pennies to garner her father's approval, then he might as well get on with it and propose. At just that moment, however, a trilling sound filled the air. The day, which until then had been gloomy, somehow felt brighter. The people turned to look at the source of the noise, and there they saw, of course, Birdie, walking down the street in a blue and yellow smock, the Suffolk colours, in an outfit with matching hose, kirtle, gown, belt, surcoat, girdle, cape, hood, and bonnet. As if rubbing it in, she even had a feather in her cap. Jaws were on the floor as she played her pipe, and all about her as the music soared, the rats around Beckles halted in their mischiefs. Those playing cards in the pub laid them down. Those in the Cartwrights stopped trying to upend wheels and send them rolling out the door. Even the group carrying the scarecrow stopped and turned, half playing along, half in a state of rapture. The only person not impressed was Mr. Peck, who looked at Birdie with a very snooty aspect. And when she stopped playing and bowed with a flourish, everyone applauded, save him. The rats, of course, went back to causing mayhem, swinging from chandeliers and doing backstroke in water troughs. But for a moment, they were forgotten. The very expert they had sought was here to save the day. What was not to like? "No, thank you," said Mr. Peck, before Birdie had even spoken.
"Pardon me?" Birdie replied.
"I said, no, thank you. Whatever this is, you, your piping, your fancy trousers, you can take them elsewhere. We have no need of outside help. Everything is under control." Well, as pompous, mean, and annoying as Mr. Peck was, it might have been difficult not to feel sympathetic for him in the moments that followed, for there was uproar. The people of the town cajoled him and complained, shouting and waggling their fingers. Someone, probably young Ashby Cowlinge, went so far as to throw a half-rotten tomato at the mayor, which was quite the gesture, as tomatoes were a valuable commodity at the time, even slightly manky ones. Birdie, however, barely noticed, for she had seen Anne, dressed in a simple woolen gown with a plain brown linen tabard on top. She was hardly dressed to impress, yet she was a pure Suffolk beauty through and through. Indeed, Birdie, being dressed as she was, in such a showy and elaborate manner, felt strangely embarrassed, as if the impression she was giving was not of herself, which was a shame, because she wanted Anne to see her.
"Daughter mine," said Blackleg, who scurried up to Birdie and tugged her on the hose at the ankle, "time to make your pitch to the people."
Roused from her imaginings, Birdie gave a mighty spit, which rebounded off the blacksmith's sign and landed in a puddle with a splash, then duly explained her proposal. She would perform her miracle, liberate Beckles from every last rat, and leave the town restored to peace and order. All she asked for in payment was all of the gold and silver the people had, and half of the food in their stores. At first, Birdie felt she may have overplayed her hand, may have asked for too much and been greedy. Yet the people of Beckles paused for only a moment before once again barracking Mr. Peck and forcing him to agree. So he and Birdie shook hands and the deal was done. To be sure he was good to his word, Birdie had Mr. Peck assemble the town's wares in a large pile in the market square. And there was, it turns out, quite a lot of it, not least from Mr. Peck's own home, where he kept all the taxes he'd collected from the people. Not that they knew, but the truth was, Mr. Peck liked to spread all the coins out on his bed and roll around in them, listening to them jingle. Still, the haul for Birdie and the rats would be fulsome, so Birdie did what she'd always intended, playing a merry song and leading the rats out of Beckles completely. And just like in previous towns and villages, the people followed on behind, watching the parade of worm-like tails, shifting fur and twitching ears as it danced and moved out towards the banks of the Waveney. There, just as planned, the creatures leapt into the drink, some even squealing with glee, being washed downstream to the woodland where they knew they'd be staying that night. Birdie, pleased with the roar of applause that arose, then retrieved Bernard, who she'd tied to a tree nearby, and her wagon, and returned to the town with the people. On arrival at the pile of goods, gold and silver, however, things got ugly.
"Well then, Piper," Mr. Peck said, "thank you so much for your services, but I must say, on second thoughts, now that the work is done, I don't think we're much minded to pay you."
"Excuse me?" said Birdie.
"Father," said Anne, who was thoroughly impressed by this pretty young stranger, not least by her ability to spit.
But the rest of the townsfolk looked to one another guiltily, for none of them particularly wanted to part with so much of their wealth. Times were hard and hearts were cold. They knew it would be cheating and that cheating was wrong, but God would forgive them. Besides, and more importantly, the rats were gone. What more could they have hoped to achieve? Nodding, and with a tongue in her cheek, Birdie took Bernard and her wagon and made her way back up the route she'd come. And when she made it to the copse where her rat family was waiting, she explained what had happened, and the rats were appalled.
"Who do these human beings think they are?" said Stubbs,
named for he had lost his tail in an accident with a pair of garden shears.
"I say, as king of rats, that we shouldn't stand for it."
Now, said One Eye, who actually had two eyes, but he'd adopted the moniker for street cred. "As you all know, I am the king of rats, but I agree with Stubbs. It's rude, ungrateful, and worst of all, it's welching."
Hisses and squeaks of approval sounded out, at which point Blackleg stepped forward.
"Having watched these strange creatures at work for some time," he said, "I know their ways. They are wily and fun and mischievous, like rats, and cunning like us too. But just as they can play games with us, we can play games with them. So come on, everyone, as king of rats, consider this my call to arms. Once more unto Beckles."
What happened next, you can imagine. For the swarm of rats descended on the town like a terribly squeaky tidal wave. People woke with rats in their hair. A man who'd just finished making a sandwich as a midnight snack was startled when, from between the pieces of bread, a rat's head emerged. And, worst of all, the rats went through all the people's kitchens and banged on pots and pans, making a tremendous racket that woke all the children, sent the dogs barking, and which led to several letters from neighbouring villages in the subsequent days to the effect of, "We know we're all dying of plague, and therefore decorum could go out the window, but we are from Suffolk. As such, please, and politely, in our last moments, do kindly keep the noise down." There was screaming and shouting, a fire broke out, and before long, Mr. Peck was once again being called for. When he failed to emerge willingly, he was then dragged out into the street in his night clothes and berated, at which point, once again, Birdie appeared. No longer dressed in finery, she looked much more as herself. With her flute in hand, she strode to the market square and coughed rather loudly. The people turned and saw her in her tattered old gown, itchy woolen hose, and with a face like unholy thunder.
"Well now," Birdie said,
"evidently, God has laid a curse on Beckles, for you have gone back on your word. So I have returned graciously and will once again help you on three specific conditions." The people were all ears, not least as, once again, a swarm of rats was parading that same scarecrow back and forth nearby, wangling it in a manner most unseemly. "Condition one is that you honour our initial agreement." To this, the people looked shamefaced and conceded, "Yes, and we're very sorry for breaking our promises." "Condition two is that you all go down on your knees and beg for forgiveness, not from me, but from the Almighty, because, as you know, he's always watching." To this, the people also conceded, though in Mr. Peck's case, rather slowly, and Birdie enjoyed watching them all, for she didn't believe in God. Rather, she just wanted to see them on their knees muttering prayers. Samson had always said it was funny to observe, and in that, as in many things, he had been correct. Once the people had done with their kneeling, begging and praying, Birdie then twirled her flute through her fingers before pointing at Mr. Peck. Now comes my third condition, and the most important, because, as you cheated me, my price has gone up. At this, there were gasps. A bit of prayer was one thing, as was honouring a prior arrangement, but an increase in their sacrifice, when they'd already given so much, and were dying, grieving, sad and in pain, well, it seemed to them rather cruel. "To what has your price gone up?" Mr. Peck said, wincing, for he knew he had fine linens and his great-grandmother's silver goblet from the coronation of William Rufus he'd not brought forward, and an enormous pork and sage sausage in his cellar that he'd been saving for a special occasion. But Birdie wanted none of that. "I want your daughter," Birdie said, "and from what I can tell, she's pretty and interesting, and I think we'd be very good friends." Anne, who then stepped forward, looked at Birdie and saw her there, beneath the light of the moon. And what Anne saw made her feel strange in her chest, and her cheeks flushed, and she realised that, instead of marrying John Woodward, she would very much like to leave Beccles with this beautiful woman and her magic flute, and go with her wherever she wanted. Well, Mr. Peck, who never much cared for Anne, readily agreed. He was happy, most of all, to not have to part with anything from his wardrobe or with his sausage. Little did he know that Blackleg and company had already raided his cellar and carried it off into the night, which was no more than he deserved. Nonetheless, in the moment, he parted with Anne, and the townsfolk gave of their savings and of their larders. And with several bags of loot, bounty and swag, Birdie loaded up her wagon, helped Anne up into the driver's seat, and the two rode away arm in arm. What they did next, well, it's none of your business, in truth. But suffice to say, they lived happily together. And although Anne was initially profoundly disturbed by all the rats, she learned to love them and to understand that on a cold night, there's nothing quite like a warm bundle to sleep in. And they had plenty, and Birdie took Anne back to the hovel to meet her three mothers. Plus, with all the gold and silver they'd earned, they never needed to play the rat trick again. Although really, what is need? For in truth, they did do it again, for fun, and to feed all the new baby rats, who were red raw and wrinkled and blind, and whose descendants still tell this story, sometimes to wizards they meet in Ipswich, passing it on through their long line of kings.
Well, Martin, you said it would be funny. You're a man of your word.
Thank you very much.
I loved the rats. Each one a king of rats, of course, and the familiars. Nice nod to Old Winter.
Oh, good, yeah. I mean, it's very much my own spin. In the original version of the story, dating from 1931, it's actually three men who all play the pipe to clear the rats from Beccles. But to gain their power, they sell their souls to the devil.
I'm guessing those are the men you've alluded to in your telling.
Yeah, and it's their flute left behind with the witches. But it's said the ghosts of those three pipers still haunt the Suffolk Brecklands to this day.
And Samson the Cat, is there really a carving of him in Aldbury Church?
There is.
But hold on, you just said 1931. That's quite late.
It is. And Charles Sampson, who's the source of the story in his book The Ghosts of the Broads, says there's a medieval ballad of this story and all sorts, but nobody's ever found them, so there's every chance he just made it up.
Ah, Charles Sampson. Perhaps a bit of a rat bag himself.
Yeah, maybe. Still, there's a long history of people called Peck being historic mayors of Beccles, and one of their daughters eloped to much scandal.
I'm guessing Birdie was made up.
She was, but Wordwell, where she was born, was a real place wiped out by the plague. But I fancied having a plucky heroine, and I'm also slightly interested in those stories you hear about children raised by animals in the wild.
Yeah, the feral child. Mm. Famous cases include the Hessian wolf children.
Yeah.
Oksana Malaya, the girl raised by dogs in Ukraine, found in the 1990s, mm-hmm. and the Lobo wolf girl of Devil's River.
Yeah, there are hundreds of them. Children raised by bears and goats and various primates. So I thought, why not rats?
Well, they're supposed seems to be very good parents, yeah. So why not rats?
Why not rats? Of course, one of the very sad things about most feral children is they very rarely find they can rejoin society. Historically, many of them died or suffered terribly. Still, well worth a bit of an internet trawl to learn more about. Very interesting.
So shall we talk correspondence?
Let's do it! And the first thing to say is thank you so much to everyone who's commented on episodes on Spotify during the break. We've had some really lovely comments on there.
In case you didn't know, you can leave a comment on any Three Ravens episode on Spotify and it helps other people find the podcast that way.
It does. And so to give you just a few highlights on last week's episode, the Folky Flash Fiction Winners episode, we had a comment from Mark who wrote, "Such a fresh and unique podcast. I've not found anything like it before."
Well, that's very nice. Thanks, Mark.
We also had messages from people binging their way through from the beginning, including Lissa, who made lots of lovely comments, including, "Thank you both for creating this lovely podcast and warm community. You guys are the best. I was fairly late to this party, so have lots to catch up on."
Oh, thank you for listening, Lissa, and well done for your awesome story and on the publication of your novel, Glass and Feathers. So exciting.
We heard from Dan, who wrote about our Hertfordshire episode, "A real trip down memory lane, as I know a lot of these places well, but was too young to appreciate the history and folklore when I lived in Hertfordshire. Thank you both, as ever, for an enjoyable trip." And from Shauna, who wrote on our Series 3 Norfolk finale, "Thank you, Martin and Eleanor. I found Three Ravens on Episode 3, and since then it has been a constant companion throughout the year. Loved the ethereal Blackshuck story to end the season."
Well, thank you to Dan and Shauna and everyone else who left Spotify comments. Please keep at it.
We also had a new review on iTunes from Eco Viking, who wrote, "Great stories. I've been listening since the beginning. Unfortunately, I fell behind, but am now catching up on 6 months' worth of episodes. I love the information and history in each episode and each story. I've also just joined the Patreon and I'm looking forward to listening to those episodes as well."
Thank you so much, Eco Viking. Really appreciate you taking the time to write that. And welcome to the Patreon, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And dear listener, if you haven't already left us a review, please do. If it's on Spotify, Apple or iTunes, we'll be sure to read it out on our next episode. But wherever you listen, if you can just drop some stars, give us a thumbs up or whatever it may be, it really helps other people to find the podcast.
It sure does. And the bigger we get, the more fun stuff we can afford to do. So please tell your friends and let's keep this conspiracy growing.
Speaking of which, we've had some lovely, lovely, lovely things happening on social media, particularly in the Three Ravens podcast group on Facebook, where people have been making friends and sharing lore and book recommendations and all sorts.
Yeah, we had articles about people finding medieval carved stone imps under their bathroom floors, about scary Wicker Men baskets for sale, lots of celebrations of the Three Ravens Folky Flash fiction stories. It's been great.
And likewise, some lovely things elsewhere, including on Instagram, where Dylan mentioned us, saying, "Hello both, I just listened to your podcast episode on Nottinghamshire as I live there and really enjoyed it. I particularly liked how the story of the witch linked together two Nottinghamshire stories, especially with using the same witch for both. Good touch. I was very interested to learn of the tradition of couvard," which is when men get kind of sympathetic symptoms of pregnancy.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
When their wives are pregnant.
As mentioned in that episode a while back.
Yeah, so Dylan continues, "Especially as my wife, a Nottinghamshire lass, has always joked about when there was no one as pregnant as her dad. Apparently, when my wife's mum was pregnant with her brother, her dad had all the symptoms of pregnancy, swollen ankles, emotional swings, as well as all the pains. So maybe there is something there after all. Anyway, just wanted to say hello and tell you to keep up the good work."
Thanks, Dylan. Such a lovely message. And Dylan also has a podcast called Tales of the Other World, where he tells stories and talks about folk tales and folklore of the East Midlands and beyond.
Lastly for today, we also heard from Erin, and I love this message. She writes, "So imagine this, I'm pootling along in my chuggy old camper van from Portsmouth to Falmouth. I've curated myself an almost perfect selection of Three Ravens episodes, Hampshire, Wiltshire, Dorset, Cornwall, to match my journey. I finish this mammoth listen, and then my Spotify switches to the next unlistened to episode, which just so happens to be the one in which I get a shout out from you guys. Thanks so much, and keep up the good work. You guys are great, and I'm learning so much."
Oh, thank you so much, Erin. When your message came through, Eleanor and I were so happy. What an awesome thing to do. time a drive through the counties to be soundtracked by episodes of Three Ravens.
It's such a good way to do what can be quite a slog of a drive.
Yeah, true.
And also, I mean, to be whipping down to Cornwall on holiday, what a lovely thing to do.
Well, I'll be talking about Cornwall in just a fortnight's time, of course, but plenty of road between now and then.
Very true. Anyhow, we've been a bit quieter on social media lately because we've been on our break. But Martin is about to start posting again with a vengeance.
I sure am. So please do join the fun on social media via facebook.com/3ravenspodcast, Instagram @3ravenspodcast, and Twitter via @3ravenspod. And if you're on Twitter, do also consider joining in with hashtag Folky Friday, a folklore themed hashtag I run celebrating different aspects of folklore. You'll find it at Folky Friday, and this Friday's theme in aid of St. Mark's Eve is dreams and nightmares.
Of course, to support the podcast and unlock tons of exclusive content, including this week's Three Ravens Film Club episode about the 2022 folk horror movie Men, please sign up for $3 a month or $6 a month at patreon.com/3ravenspodcast, and email us your 3,000-word ghost stories to 3ravenspodcast@gmail.com.
Likewise, please keep sending in your local lore, folkloric facts and curious nuggets of knowledge to that same address, 3ravenspodcast@gmail.com. And check out this month's 3Ravens Book Club pick, Song of the Huntress by Lucy Holland.
We will, of course, be back on Thursday with our first Magic and Medicine bonus episode of Series 4, where I'm going to be talking all about crystals.
Yeah.
Then Martin's interview with Kirsty Hartziotis also comes out on Saturday.
As for next week's episode, Eleanor, we've mentioned it already, but you're taking us to Somerset.
I sure am. And because we were trying to keep episodes short this time last year, there's so much to say, I'm kind of overwhelmed.
Well, either way, I can't wait. And in the meantime, while our story's gone that way, we'll go this way.
And remember, don't whistle till you're out of the woods.
Thanks and credit go to Kirsty Hartziotis for her book, Suffolk Folk Tales, Christopher Reeve's book, Paranormal Suffolk, and Robert Halliday's book, Suffolk, Strange But True, all of which were incredibly useful in my research for this episode.
Our theme song is the traditional folk ballad Three Ravens, performed by Eleanor Conlon and Ben Harbour. And our logo is by Ollie James Dare.
The Three Ravens podcast is a Rust and Stardust production, written and produced by me, Martin Vaux. Thanks for listening.
God send every gentleman such hounds, such hawks, such leemen, with a down, derry, 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 down, down.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.